Star Walker Studios presents Game Master's Journey, your multidimensional RPG podcast. Hello, gamer! Welcome to episode 120 of Game Master's Journey. I'm your host, Lex Starwalker. I've been running RPG games for over 25 years, and on this show, we discuss the craft of game mastering, and I share what I've learned over the years. Listeners and GMs like you also add to the conversation and share your thoughts, experiences, and wisdom. My hope is that together we can become game masters truly worthy of the title. I've gotten a lot of great feedback on episode 119, in which I discussed the expansion of Alandria, and I've also gotten some more great feedback on episode 118, where I discussed the old magic of Primordia. I'll go over some of that feedback today and my thoughts on it. Also, I want to remind you that I'm gathering feedback for a couple future episodes I want to do. I'd like to do an episode on gaming in between sessions and how to keep player interest high in between your gaming sessions, especially when maybe you have to miss a week or a few weeks in between sessions. Also, how to deal with players who are absent for a given session. And there is a link in the show notes at starwalkerstudios.com to a discussion on our Google Plus community about this, where you can give any ideas that you have and any experiences you've had with trying different techniques of keeping player engagement high in between sessions. And the other topic I want to cover on a future episode is tips and tricks for using theater to the mind in your tabletop RPG. So if you're a GM who uses theater of the mind and you have any advice for newer GMs or GMs that just aren't used to using theater of the mind, again, I'll have a link in the show notes to a thread on that in the community where you can give me your thoughts and ideas, and I'll share them with everyone in a future episode. So after producing episode 119, I got some more great feedback on episode 118, including some thoughts from G-Ferg, who says, old magic or deep magic or whatever is always cool and fun. It adds that element of mystery and hidden power that I jive with. Though I can't say I'm a fan of mixing magic and hyper-technology. That's just my personal taste. Ultimately, you can and should do as you like, and you can just hand wave it and no biggie. Though I'd guess the only payoff would be the one big reveal that it is technology. But then after that, there wouldn't be many more payoffs like that or any that would have the same impact. And yeah, G-Ferg, I completely agree. And that's probably in a nutshell the biggest reason that I'm starting to lean away from the old magic really being technology idea, is because it really boils down to that. You know, in a given campaign or with a given group of players, I'm going to have that one moment where I reveal that, oh, this ancient magic is really technology. And you'll have that one moment of surprise from the players, and that's it. That's really the only payoff for it. And you only get that moment once with any given group of players. And is it really worth the headache just for that one brief payoff? And I don't really think it is, especially since in some ways it kind of goes against what I'm wanting to do with Primordia, and it kind of goes against the feel that I like my D&D games to have. G-Ferg goes on to say, also I tend to find that players do like mysteries, but they also need answers. And if they found that they aren't getting any answers, it might be a bit frustrating to them. And they would probably want to get their hands on whatever different fancy world mythology bits they could. At least that's what my experience has been. And I completely agree, and I think I touched on this a little bit in episode 119, that I completely agree. Mysteries are great, but one of the major aspects that makes a mystery great is the ability to solve it, you know, and just throwing mysteries at your players with no solution is not going to be satisfying for them in the long run. And if you have players who do kind of go after a mystery and decide to solve it, and if you haven't come up with a good solution yourself and you end up just pulling one out of your ass to satisfy your players, that thing that you pull out of your ass at the last second probably isn't going to be fantastic and may not satisfy them, you know, when they go to all this effort to solve this mystery and then the solution is kind of lame. So that's why I really recommend using the concept of not worrying about the solution to the mystery yourself very sparingly. And I would limit that to mysteries that the PCs don't really grab onto. But if you're throwing mysteries at your PCs, as soon as your players grab onto one of those and get interested and start investigating it, that should be your cue to figure out what's going on with this mystery behind the scenes if you haven't already. So G4 goes on to say, I'd say, why not just keep the old magic mysterious as a whole? No one knows exactly what it is. Some strange advanced technology? Maybe it's something psychic, mind magic made into matter, or the highest long-forgotten form of magic that players only touch on with their simplified understanding, say, comparing addition and subtraction to calculus. Or maybe something that they don't even have a clue about at all, something so old and so mysterious that no one even came close to understanding it at this point. That way you can hand wave and never really have to dole out too much information or explanations, let alone mechanics at all. Just know it's old, powerful, and the greatest minds on Primordia have failed to understand it for eons. Yeah, and I think that's really great advice. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that I'm looking for with the old magic is really something that's not understandable today. And, you know, making it ancient technology is one way to do that, but you could just make it some ancient form of magic that for whatever reason, people can't figure out today. You know, it could be as simple as that in the old days when the old magic was used, it took millennia to figure out. And all of that knowledge has since been lost. So it would take millennia to figure it out again. And, you know, people aren't super motivated to do that since they have the new magic, which works. And, you know, maybe the old magic is better or more powerful or whatever. But if you have magic that works that you can do right now, it's hard to motivate to spend thousands of years trying to figure out a different type of magic that you may never figure out. So I imagine outside of the guild, there's probably not anyone trying to figure out or understand the old magic. All right, so G4 goes on to comment about the mythals or the magical force fields and the gates of Alandria and Primordia. And you'll probably notice that I've been using the term mythal less and less because the reason is that I think as I develop my force fields more and more that the term mythal applies to them less and less. Ultimately, I'll have to come up with my own catchy term for something to call them, but haven't come up with anything yet. You could do something different with them, no matter how you explain the old magic. You can just say that people have figured out how to use them, and G-Ferk's talking about the mythals and the portals here. But that doesn't mean they know how to use every aspect or that they know how they work. Just like if you hand a child a tablet, they can figure out how to do some things, but not everything, and they can't build or program a tablet either. And yeah, that's a really great point, and that's kind of where I'm at with both the mythals and the portals right now, is I'm thinking that those are based on the old magic, and they were created millennia ago by an ancient civilization using the old magic. And basically, the guild has figured out enough that they can use them, and at least in the case of the portals, they can create new portals. But they don't really understand how they work, or at least not to the degree that they could develop new magic using the same principles. Perhaps the Mythals are remnants of the founders of old magic, and cities cropped up around them for protection or some such. And yeah, that's basically kind of my idea, is that it's these really ancient cities that have been around for thousands of years that have these Mythals, and they were built by an ancient civilization. And right now I'm thinking they were built by an ancient elven civilization, but that could change. Also, if you wanted some more flavor, you could have a different quality to them. Perhaps the Mythals and portals are sort of alive. Maybe they are grown as opposed to built, like a fancy magical coral. And yeah, that's a cool idea, and that might be kind of where I go with it. Actually, the genesis of my whole thought about making the old magic really technology came from when I was thinking about the keystones that are used to create the portals. And I did have this idea, like what G. Ferg is talking about here, that the keystones are almost like a seed that grows the portal around it. And as I was thinking about that, you know, the idea entered my head of self-replicating nanotechnology, and oh, wouldn't it be cool if these magical keystones that are like seeds that grow portals are really technological devices that use nanotech, and everybody's using them like they're magic and thinking of them that way, but they're really not. So that's kind of where that idea actually came from, was from the keystones. And now I've kind of come around full circle, you know, kind of like what G. Ferg and other people have said, is that, well, I don't need it to be technology to do that. You know, it could be that part of the old magic was the ability to create magical constructs that would be able to themselves create still greater magical constructs and or replicate themselves. And that could be part of what made the old magic special, because at least to my knowledge, there's no magic in D&D right now that really does that, where you can have a magic item that will itself create a more powerful magic item or be able to make copies of itself. At least that I can think of off the top of my head, there's nothing like that in D&D. So that could be a limitation of the quote new magic, is that it can't self-replicate where the old magic could. Kind of like the new magic is drawing upon an energy source that is finite, while the old magic drew upon an energy source that was infinite. G. Ferg goes on to say, maybe that's the whole point of the guild, to find all the magic stuff, because they're trying to understand the old magic. And yeah, that's exactly it. That's one of the root purposes of the guild. And somewhere, I don't have it on me right now, or I'd share it with you, I wrote out kind of a guild motto, and there were a handful of objectives that the guild has that's kind of their mission statement. And one of those objectives is to discover the ancient magics and try to unlock their secrets. Maybe they figured out just enough to make a new portal, but they still don't exactly understand how or why they work, like with alchemists with chemistry. And yeah, that's exactly it. You know, they know enough to use them and to make new ones, but they don't know enough to know what to do, for instance, when something goes wrong. Maybe the portals require magic items to work. Hence why the guild is only seeking them. Perhaps items are needed in portal creation. And yeah, that's a possibility. Other people have put forward the idea that maybe the portals and even the Mythals require energy, and maybe that energy is provided by basically sacrificing magic items. They draw power by draining magic items. So that's an idea, and I may go somewhere with that in the future. But right now I'm thinking that the old magic is drawing on a power source in such a way that it's kind of infinite. And so objects that are created with the old magic, like the portals and like the Mythals surrounding the city, don't ever run out of power. They last forever and maybe even grow in power over time. And that's one of the big differences between the old magic and the magic that's practiced today in Primordia. So yeah, the keystones that the guild uses to create the portals are actually items made with the old magic that are able to replicate themselves. So the guild doesn't even create the keystones. They basically found one somewhere, you know, thousands of years old, and figured out how to use it and figured out that it could make copies of itself. So they can't even create keystones from scratch. They need a current keystone in order to create a copy. And the same thing with the mythals. The mythals are created by a magical device or artifact that is an item of the old magic. And the guild, you know, these don't self-replicate, or if at least if they do, the guild hasn't figured out how to get them to do that, which is why they're not putting mythals up around new cities. There's only the ones that already exist and have existed for millennia. But they're studying them, and they're getting to the point now that they think they can make a lesser version of a mythal. And that's what they're considering trying to put around some of the estates outside of Alandria that have been abandoned and lost to the wilds. But, you know, creating one of these new experimental mythals is kind of like cooking with ingredients you've never tasted. You know, you may have a recipe and you may follow the recipe, but things could still go horribly wrong no matter how good that recipe is. And keep in mind that the recipe itself may be flawed because they don't have an actual set of instructions for how to build a mythal. They're kind of reverse engineering them, magically speaking. G4 goes on to say, I like the idea of them being tied to the old magic. It gives them some additional gravitas and maybe even reverence, as well as keeping some mystery to them, leaving the option open for them to do other things as well as is needed for the story. And yeah, that's a great point. And that's a great thing about the fact that they're not completely understood is I could always sometime in the future come up with some other thing that the portals or the mythals can do that's newly discovered. And G. Ferg says maybe the keystones are what are initially built and then they are put in place and prepared. And then from that, they grow a portal, which would add some weirdness. And yeah, that's basically how it works. You know, I've kind of, the way I've been thinking of it for the most part up to this point is that that humans actually build the portal around the keystone, but the keystone is what makes that portal then magical and gives it all its properties. But another way I could go is just, you know, you put the keystone in place and you cast a spell or do a ritual or something, and then it grows the portal around it. That could be kind of cool too. But I kind of like the idea of them having to construct the portals and the keystone is then put into place and it kind of activates it. Just because I want the creation of these portals to be kind of a labor-intensive, expensive, time-consuming process as opposed to just pushing a button on a magic item. Brett Nilsson also wrote in with some comments on episode 118. And he liked something I said in the show. I said, don't tell the players more than you want them to know. Brett says, best advice I've never learned. I love having mysteries in my stories, but I always get so excited about story ideas that it's a terrible internal struggle to keep from telling the players all about them. And yeah, I'm right there with you, man. I've struggled with this ever since I've started running games, and I've ruined some great reveals in campaigns in the past by letting slip too much to the players just because I was so excited about what was going to happen and these cool ideas I've had. And I suggested to Brett that we need like a GM support group where we GMs can tell our cool ideas to each other so that we're not so tempted to give them away to the players too soon. But I guess that's kind of what the Game Master's Journey Google Plus community is a GM support group. So I guess if you are a GM and you've got some great secrets that are just burning to be told and you don't want to tell your players, you can always tell us on the community. Although I guess that doesn't work if your players listen to the show or read the community. So I don't know, maybe we need a special place where you have to log into and only GMs can go there. But then a lot of GMs are players and vice versa. So I guess you just have to be careful who you talk to. Brett goes on to say, old magic or old world magic is a favorite of mine, but I've personally moved away from the magic equals ancient or modern technology genre bending. I blame Dolph Lundgren and Masters of the Universe circa 1980s. I've actually never seen those. Maybe I should, or maybe I shouldn't. Old magic, though, is something that has interested me as a means of showing the remnants of an old civilization. Possibly the vestiges of the gods who made or ruled the world in the last age. Lingering effects from a natural or magical cataclysm that ended the last age and created the new. 30 years later, I still can't say cataclysm without thinking of Raistlin Majere. Thank you, Weiss and Hickman. Yeah, I'm the same way. Raistlin is just part of our culture now. We just can't change that. I actually knew someone in college that named their kid Raistlin. Poor kid. But anyway, I like most, I think, the idea of elements in the world that can't be categorized and explained by the rules the characters know. And yeah, I totally agree. Mysteries are fantastic. And, you know, one of the tropes of D&D, you know, settings is that it's an ancient world and there's been many fallen civilizations and that some of those civilizations at least could do things with magic that can't be done today. And I think you can see this in most, if not all, of the published D&D settings. Boz Bunnick also commented on Google Plus and said, my first thought on it would be, please no. But then when I think about it, I'm just not sure. To me, the problem with having some kind of technology is that you would, in principle, be able to take it apart and study it. Probably not the PCs, but someone could, for example, the guild, and reproduce some of its effect, etc. And again, I think that's true if you're assuming a pretty low level of technology. If you're assuming technology from like the 1900s or the 1800s, pre-digital age technology, then maybe some of it, yes. But I think we're maybe kind of forgetting here like how far we've come and how much we've learned that we've built on to have the technology today. Even something as relatively, quote, low tech as, say, GPS would be way beyond someone in a D&D world, even the guild's ability to figure out or reverse engineer. So you imagine technology from a civilization that can travel deep space and harness the energy of a planet and even an entire star system. And any technology that they developed would never be able to be figured out by someone in a D&D world. So I actually think that you have more problem of that with magic, which is to say, you know, the PCs or someone else in the world being able to figure it out than you do with technology. Even if it's an old magic that works under completely different principles, people in a D&D setting still have a concept of magic and have a body of knowledge that they can start to build on. When it comes to technology, they don't have that. I mean, you're looking at a level of technology that doesn't go far beyond simple machines and things like crossbows and trebuchets and stuff like that. You know, there's no computers, there's no real engines, there's nothing like that. So if you've never seen or heard of anything like that before, how do you even conceive of it or understand it if you're put face to face with it? I don't know. So Boz goes on to say, I guess it really depends on your game and your players, but unless it is somehow possible to reproduce the technology, does it really matter whether you think about it as technology or magic? And no, it doesn't matter. And that was kind of my point, is it doesn't matter at all. It's just a flavor thing. The only thing that's going to matter is how you describe it. For instance, if the Keystones are really utilizing nanotechnology to replicate themselves and to grow portals around them, then I would describe the functioning of a Keystone and someone watching a portal being created much differently than I would if they're magical devices. Again, it wouldn't have any impact on how the portals work or how much the player characters do or don't understand them or the mechanics or anything like that. The only thing it would affect is how I describe them, the flavor of them. And Boss says, I feel like I would just stick with magic to prevent even the thought occurring of trying to replicate it. And again, Boss is coming from a point of view of thinking that technology would be easier to replicate, but I actually believe the opposite. I think magic would be easier to replicate because the characters in the world have a concept of magic. They don't really have a concept of technology, not technology like what we think of, not technology that's beyond what we have today. They have no concept of that would be magic. They wouldn't even have a word technology to describe that. Boss says, I like what you say about Primordia being shielded. And I was talking about, if I went the technology route, I was kicking around the idea of Primordia somehow being isolated from the rest of the universe. So you can't just fly a spaceship there. So that's what he's talking about here. He says it could be something like the city shields. It could even have been made by the gods to have their own playing ground, or for some other reason you come up with when you need it, or even to prevent foul play by other gods and by demons, etc. And yeah, that's totally right on. And I might actually go that way, even though I'm probably not going to do the technology thing, because I do have established that there's only 9 gods in Primordia, and I've been wondering, how is it that there are only 9 gods when there are portals opening all the time and rifts opening all the time? You think there'd be just countless gods, like you have in Forgotten Realms. That's not the case, so we need to explain that. And so maybe Primordia being somehow shielded or quarantined or isolated from the rest of the universe or the multiverse by the deities, and that's how they keep other deities from coming in, that makes sense. That could be a way to do that. I see the 9 gods of Primordia as presenting a unified front versus any outside deities that would try to come in and get a foothold. You know, the gods of Primordia don't all get along with each other, but they stand united against interlopers. They don't want to share or lose any of their power. And this just makes sense to me. And the whole thing that we have, like in the Forgotten Realms, where we have numerous gods with the same portfolio elements, it just doesn't make sense. You know, if you have 5 gods of war, then it stands to reason each of those gods of war is far less powerful than they would be if there was only 1 god of war. Because that one portfolio element, war, instead of being the domain of 1 god, is divided up against 5 of them. And how is that divided up anyway? Regionally, temporally, arbitrarily is my guess. So it just doesn't make sense why gods would allow that to happen. My guess with Forgotten Realms, if anyone's even given it that much thought, is that the answer is that it happened in such a way that they couldn't prevent it or something like that. But in Primordia, the gods aren't going to let that happen. So Boz says, you know, these gods have a world to play with and it's their world. I imagine having all the portals and rifts opening on the planet would have these gods being very wary of any outsiders trying to take over their nice little system that they've got. It also plays nice with the gods insisting on everyone using their real name only, something of a safeguard to help prevent any back doors opening. And yeah, that's a really good point. Boz says, I think I would even ponder the idea that the mythals are tied in to patron gods of cities too. Maybe it could even depend on how well the gods get along, whether the portals between certain cities work. And yeah, that's a really fascinating idea. I have kicked around the idea that maybe the mythals are actually powered by the gods somehow. For instance, the patron deity of Alandria is Ion, goddess of knowledge. So maybe she's involved with the mythal around the city somehow. Maybe she created it, or maybe she's maintaining it somehow. I don't know. It's a cool idea. And I really like Boz's idea here that if that's the case, that you may have certain cities that have patron deities that don't get along, and so you're not going to find portals connecting those cities together. I think that's a pretty cool idea.
This is Matthew Colville, and you're listening to Game Master's Journey.
This is the part of the show where I give a shout out and thank you to all the patrons of Starwalker Studios. You all make this show possible. Thank you very much for your support. And I also want to especially thank my tier 4 patron, Mr. Steve Strickland. Let's hear it for Steve.
Yeah.
Colonel Steve.
Yes.
You're the man.
So as a thank you for their support, patrons get some cool little perks from me for being a patron of Starwalker Studios. Among those, a monthly podcast I do just for the patrons. And I also upload some of my Primordia content for the patrons to use in their home games or as inspiration. So you can find out all about being a patron of Starwalker Studios on my Patreon page. And you can find the link to that at the top of the show notes at starwalkerstudios.com. All right, going to change gears a little bit now and start discussing some of the feedback I got on episode 119, the most recent episode, in which I was talking about the expansion of Alandria, this idea of Alandria trying to reclaim some of the noble estates that have been lost outside the city and reinforcing those with smaller versions of the mythal that protects Alandria. And also the thought of player characters being able to have strongholds and followers. So I heard from G. Ferg on this episode as well, and he says, "Nice one, dude. I think building and mentioning strongholds, guilds, secret societies, and such works great with the downtime mechanic." And I completely agree. I am a huge fan of the downtime mechanics in 5th edition. This is something that's been sorely needed in the game since the very beginning. And it's just so great to have a way now to handle times when the characters aren't on an adventure. And, you know, if you run a campaign from level 1 to 20 and you are chronicling every minute of every day of an adventurer's life, you're going to end up with this character who starts as, you know, a dirty farmer with a pitchfork or something and ends up, you know, just shy of a demigod in a very, very short amount of time. And it just stretches credibility beyond belief that someone could grow that far that fast. So you got to have downtime just for realism and just so that, you know, your character's entire adventuring career doesn't take place in the span of a few months. And it's just great that now we have a few guidelines on some things that you could do with that. And even more than really what's in the DMG and the player's handbook for downtime, because let's face it, there's really not much. But to me, I'm just glad it's there because it kind of opens that floodgate. Because it's like, here's a few ideas of what you could do with downtime. Now take it and run with it. And that's kind of how I interpret that. I don't see that as Wizards trying to be like, here's everything you could do with downtime. They're just giving us a few examples to kind of show us where they're coming from, and then we can come up with all kinds of stuff. I love that. And G-Ferg says, "I could have some strongholds in the city, like a fortified manor. Granted, it isn't as open-ended as something further out, but you can have guild fights, intrigue, roguish-type games, and things like that with that." And yeah, absolutely, totally could. That's just not the campaign I want to run or play. But yeah, you could totally do that. Regarding the idea of the portable mythals, G-Ferg says, "I think that can work. Just limit the power and range. It would still keep the main city mythals of the utmost importance and limit the distance that you could go. As they are less powerful, they may still be subject to attack, and they might have to haul it back to the city mythal. Maybe what they can fend off is challenge rating based." Yeah, you know, and that's a few different ways I could go with it. I'm definitely thinking that the guild's understanding of the mythals and how they work is not perfect. The implementation of these smaller mythals is not going to be perfect. There's going to be problems. People have presented the idea of maybe they need some kind of energy source, and maybe they need to be recharged, or maybe they need to be connected to the main mythal to get energy from that. And I don't know about all that. That's going to get a little bit too fiddly for me, I think. I think instead what I'm going to do is just say that they're not perfect and they don't always work, or they don't always work the way that you think they're going to work. So there could be times that maybe the missile just goes down and it just doesn't work for a while. And now you've got to defend your stronghold extra vigorously for a while until the thing comes back online. Or maybe you find out that there's certain creatures it doesn't defend against that the big one does, or there's certain times that it doesn't work as well, or certain times that its energy is low, or something like that. And probably what I would do, for instance, in an adventure, if I was writing an adventure using this, is I would probably have a chart of suggested things that could go wrong with the mythal. And then the DM could either roll on that or could just pick something. And, you know, maybe I would have a, oh, there's this percent chance on a given day that something goes wrong. And I mean, if this were something I were publishing, I would probably do that just for people that like that kind of thing. But me personally, I would just do it when it was dramatically appropriate. I wouldn't be rolling dice to figure out if or when a mythal fails. I would do it when it was a good time to do it. And I had a good reason and something fun to do with it. Regarding my thoughts about where to put the portals within the city and my idea that they're not accessible at night, G. Ferg says that I'm not sure if shutting down gates at night would be feasible. I mean, if it's connected to a city very far away, what if it's night soon somewhere else? Or what if one place is night and the other's day? Yeah, that's a possible problem. First of all, I don't think that any of the cities that are connected to Alandria right now are that far away. You're probably talking no more of a greater difference than comparing the West and the East Coast of the U.S. So there might be a few hours difference in local time, but it's not going to be to the point where, you know, it's like a different day or a different time of day, you know, that kind of thing. And it's basically going to be based on Alandria time, because I'm picturing Alandria now as kind of the hub of the portal network. Alandria is a city where the guild was founded. Alandria is where the first portals were built. So the first portals were built in Alandria, connecting Alandria to other cities. And then since then, more portals have been built in those cities, connecting them to still other cities. But right now, Alandria is the city with the most portals. It's kind of like the hub. So a lot of other cities, like let's say Alandria is city A and you've got city B wants to build a portal to city C. Well, probably it can already be done by just taking a portal to Alandria and then taking a portal from Alandria to city C, because Alandria probably already has that portal. But if it doesn't, it might still be more efficient to first go to Alandria and then from there to another place that's closer to City C, and then from there go to City C to build your portal or whatever. So I'm definitely seeing Alandria as kind of a focal point of this portal network. And so the portals overall operate on Alandria time. So, you know, all the portals that connect to Alandria are open from sunrise and sunset Alandria local time. So that might mean in a given city, you know, their portal to Alandria is opening an hour before dawn and closing an hour before sunset or something like that. But again, it's only going to be a disparity of a few hours at most. And, you know, that's just kind of the price you pay for not being Alandria and not being the focal point of the network is maybe it's not quite as elegant as sunrise to sunset in your city, for instance. But I do like the idea of them only being open during the day, because why would they be open at night? I mean, what kind of legitimate business is going to be carried out in those hours? And also, I think just from a security point of view, it wouldn't be advisable to have them open all the time, because keep in mind, while the portal is open, you need a much stronger guard on it than when it's not. And so the idea is that there's at least a few hours every day that the portals are closed down, so they don't need to be guarded quite so rigorously during that time. And maybe even more importantly, from kind of a running the game perspective, is it leaves this possibility for having people that do have the ability to use the portals at night by paying off people in the guild or whatever. Allows some politics to worm its way into the system. Gifer goes on to say, if you want to have the portals inside the guild hall, I'd say maybe a structure built off to the side that can be closed when necessary, but still very able to be opened wide for the vast amount of transit. Kind of what I'm thinking about this is when I was in Geneva, something I saw there that I thought was really cool that I've never seen here in America was they had basically alleys that had these big wooden doors, and at night they would close and lock those doors. So there were certain alleys in the city that you just couldn't use at night. And I thought that was really cool, just kind of conceptually. And so that's kind of what I'm thinking with the guild hall and the portals is it might actually, the guild hall might, well, first of all, it's probably pretty large and might actually entail almost kind of a small district of the city. And so the square itself where the portals are might actually be outside and might be outside of the guild hall, but you can only access that part of the city during certain times of the day. So it's not necessarily inside the structure of the hall itself, but it's still something that can be closed off to people when needed, for instance, at night. DM Nell also commented and said, just finished listening. I'm almost a little disappointed as it sounds like you're considering going back on one of the things that set Primordia apart, which is that your world is mostly dangerous wilderness with magically protected cities far apart from each other, requiring portals to travel between. If you are going to start building mini mythals for towns and or roads and creating suburbs, you're basically going to have another Forgotten Realms. I'd suggest that rather than that, consider going for more fantastic solutions for population control, such as building upwards with vast towers or creating floating islands or growing downwards with subterranean cities and strongholds. So yeah, those are all cool ideas. But again, you know, the main reason I'm doing this isn't because I can't come up with other ways to deal with the population problem. It's because I want player characters to have strongholds and I want them to have buildings. I want them to have followers and estates. And I don't want those to be limited to being in the city because I think that's boring. And again, leads to a kind of gameplay that I don't want, which is a city-based campaign. I want monsters and weird vistas and stuff like that, all of which, you know, you're not going to have in a city. Problem with city-based campaigns is, you know, you're fighting a lot of other humans and humanoids, and it's just kind of boring to me. If I want a game like that, I'd probably run something modern, like World of Darkness or something. I think is much better suited to something like that than D&D. Think about your monster manual and how much of that you would never use if your campaign never left the city. Like 90% of that you probably would never use. So that's the real reason behind why I'm doing the expansion. And I totally hear what DM Nell is saying here, but I mean, it's a question of degree, right? You know, if Alandria expands to a handful of estates that are just outside the mythal, it's not going to be the Forgotten Realms. There's still the vast majority of the world is wilderness. And keep in mind, too, that Primordia is basically a super Earth. So it's much larger than even the Forgotten Realms. So I could have just as many civilized areas as the realms have, and it would still be mainly wilderness because the planet is so much bigger. But you know, this is something that's going to happen very slowly. And, you know, in the adventure, the PCs are literally going to be the first ones to do this. So at the time of the adventure, there are no other places outside of Alandria. You know, this is the first one that they're attempting, and there's no guarantee that the PCs will, first of all, be successful of clearing the castle of what's already there. And second, there's no guarantee that the guild is going to be successful in building a mythal that actually works around it. So I or any DM could throw a wrench in the gears either of those two places. And even if it is successful, you know, what happens next? And, you know, I don't think that you're going to see 50 estates reclaimed within the first few years, for instance. It's not going to happen that quickly. DM now goes on to say, as far as politics go, I'm not great at that stuff in my campaign. So take what I'm about to say with a grain of salt. Yeah, I'm the same way. But I'd suggest that the movers and shakers will do just about anything to get control of the portals, and that if the agreement to keep them free to use for the public was made by the Queen, then those who want control of the portals will be looking to get rid of the Queen and get another monarch in place that sees things their way. There would be so much political intrigue and pressure to try and change that policy that it would require a very strong queen to keep the peace. Yeah, I'm not sure that I agree with that, because I think you're overlooking the guild here. And the guild made the agreement with the queen, and I see what you're saying, like, oh, well, if we take out the queen, then we have to make a new agreement or whatever. But I don't really think that's the case, because the guild is extremely powerful. And the guild has the means themselves to uphold and enforce the agreement and to keep others from encroaching on their territory, which is to say control of the portals. You know, they made the agreement with the queen in good faith as a mutually beneficial arrangement. You know, they didn't have to make that deal. They chose to. So just because someone else deposes the queen or something doesn't mean that the guild is going to play nice with them. And in fact, they probably wouldn't. In fact, they would probably protect the queen and her throne, because again, they're benefiting from this deal, and who knows what kind of deal they could or would make with whoever replaces the queen. So it's in their interest to keep the queen on her throne. And, you know, the queen's got the nobles behind her. To a large degree, she's got the merchants behind her, and she's got the guild behind her. So it'd be pretty tough for anyone to really undermine that, I think. DMNL says, I catch myself doing things in my campaign world that contradict what my design goals were to begin with, which is why I have a 10 unique things about the world in my notebook to remind me. For example, the number one thing in my world, which is the Broken World campaign, is that the world is broken into pieces floating in the ether, and nothing the PCs will ever do will change that. They may think that they can fix it by finding the gods or some artifact, but they can't and won't ever be able to fix it, because it's a core feature of the setting. And yeah, that's a really good point. And I would recommend that anyone who's building their own world do something like that, like have a list or something that tells you, you know, this is what makes my world unique. These are the key things about my world that make it what it is. You know, mess with these at your peril. And I don't know if I'd go to say, so far as to say that you can't change any of those things, but you definitely want to think long and hard about it if you're going to change one of those things. And you don't want to change one of those things willy-nilly, or just change it without realizing that you're fundamentally changing what your world is. And I think if the PCs can be a vehicle for change of one of those things, that could actually be really cool, because that's really going to get buy-in from your players, because they can say, hey, when we started, the world was like this, and now we've changed it in these ways to something else because of things that we did. And I think that's really cool, as long as you, as the dungeon master and the world builder and the designer of this world, are okay with what the world is going to become. But if you're not, then I think it's totally fine to, like DMNL says, say there are just certain things about your setting that just can't be changed or won't be, because that's what makes your setting unique. So for instance, with Primordia, you know, I would say one of the core concepts of the setting is this idea of rifts opening to other planes, almost, or at least seemingly, at random. So although I can have things like mythals around certain cities that prevent that from happening in that location, I'm never going to have NPCs of Primordia figure out a way to stop the rifts from ever opening so that Primordia is safe everywhere. Like, that's never going to happen, because that would make it a completely different place, and that would violate one of the core things that makes Primordia what it is. Now, putting mythals and portals around every city and village in the campaign setting, I don't think necessarily would break my setting. It definitely would change it. It would change the feel of it. But I think because the world is so big, I could still have tons of wilds. And I think the setting wouldn't lose what at its core makes it Primordia. But it's still something that I would think long and hard about before I decided to do it. And, you know, at this point, you know, I could see the campaign setting being on a trajectory towards that. But at the timeline where we're at in the setting where I'm going to be running adventures, that is just at the very beginning. And we're just seeing the birth of that. And it's going to be centuries, if not thousands of years before it ever gets to that point. If it ever really gets to that point, probably won't. And I do like the idea of the city growing vertically, both up and down. And that's something I may play more with in the future. And it is true, you know, if this expansion grew beyond a certain point, you know, it could lose some of the uniqueness of the setting, but it's not going to grow beyond that point, or at least it's not going to grow beyond that point anytime in the near future, anytime within the timeline of actual adventures and campaigns I run in the setting, or at least in this setting. Because remember, I could have very different settings in different time periods on the same world. Now, one other idea that I've had that I don't think I've shared on the show is I've had this idea that the guild hall in Alandria actually has a secret portal inside of it that nobody outside of the guild knows about. And indeed, only the higher ranking people in the guild know about it. So even player characters who are, I don't know, below like, say, 10th level, don't even know this portal exists. And this portal leads to a central guild hall, which is actually on a demiplane. And the idea here is that all of the guild halls in the world connect via portal to this guild hall that's on a demiplane. And that's where the real magical treasures and secrets and all the stuff that the guild really doesn't want falling into the wrong hands, that's where all that stuff is kept. And it also allows the guild to be able to work as a unified entity, even though it's spread out all over the planet. Because basically, as easily as walking into another room in your house, someone in the guild can go to the central hall and meet with the inner council of the guild or whatever. Now, I do like the idea that DM Nell presented here of moving against the queen. And I think that's something I may explore in the future. I just think that it's going to be a huge undertaking and probably would require quite a coalition of various groups and entities and forces because, again, you know, the queen has a lot behind her, including the guild. So it would be the backbone of a campaign, I think, but it would be really cool. I think it'd be really cool. Another idea I'm playing around with is that of the guild having at least two different factions within it. And one of those factions, which is a secret faction that only members of the faction even know exist, is not so benevolent as the guild usually is and thinks that the guild should have all the power. I mean, the guild could rule the world, so the guild should rule the world. And they're working in secret to take control of the guild for themselves so that they can run the guild the way they think it should be run. And once they take control of the guild, they'll take control of the cities and rule the world in an iron fist. So if this faction prevails, the days of free use of the portals for all citizens would be over. You know, my thoughts are that this is something that the PCs could get involved in later in the campaign, like at high level play. They could find out about this secret faction and maybe work to uncover it and overthrow it. And I think that could be a lot of fun. G Ferg also commented on episode 119 and said, I don't know. I think a bit of spidering out of the mythals from the cities can work if it's handled like a limited resource or something. Since one of the foundations of D&D is exploration, I wouldn't want to make that really limited. And yeah, I agree. And, you know, that's part of it too, is I need a way to have exploration in the game and to make it a little more accessible than it is right now. I think the main thing is how much control over land does civilization have? With the main cities being under mythals, it's really not very much land at all that would be tamed. Yeah, and that's a really good point. Even if some roads or keeps were also mythaled, I like how you turn that into a verb, the vast majority of land would still be untamed and fairly dangerous. And yeah, that's totally what I'm thinking. You know, even if we fast forward a few decades and maybe Alondra has reclaimed, I don't know, a dozen keeps or so, it's still a very, very small part of the world overall that's been, quote, tamed. So I don't think it would ruin the uniqueness or flavor, since the basic gist is in the wild, rifts open and anything can happen. And that hasn't been changed. I do like the City of Portals idea. I think that's neat. And the portal to the Guild Hall and rival factions. So thank you guys for those comments on episode 19, or 119, I should say. Really appreciate it. I love getting feedback from my listeners, and you guys give me a lot of great ideas and help propel episodes like this one. And I just love hearing from you. So if you would like to get in touch with the show, whether to share an idea or suggest a topic for a future episode, or just say hi, you can email me at gamemastersjourney@gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter @LexStarwalker, and you can follow me on Google plus LexStarwalker. And also check out the website at starwalkerstudios.com/gamemastersjourney. And you can find all the episodes and show notes there. You can find links to my Patreon page, my YouTube channel, all kinds of stuff at starwalkerstudios.com. Josh Davis also wrote in on episode 119 and says, great episode and a good follow-up discussion here. And he's talking about the discussion on the Google Plus community, which is where a lot of this is coming from today. I think introducing strongholds of some kind is always a great way to help anchor player characters to the setting. Yeah, I completely agree. Give them some ownership, right? I began to make heavy use of the Stronghold Builder's Guidebook right before I switched from 3.5 to 5th edition because I was enjoying spending my gold on something that made my character more than just the best murder hobo in the land, but gave him a more solid presence in the area where he settled. There is a great homebrew supplement for 5e somewhere on the internet that does some of the stronghold building, but the way you were discussing it, I think you were just going to pre-design the stronghold for your characters. And yeah, that's kind of what I'm thinking, yeah. I love the idea of making a part of the stronghold applicable to each of your players. I had a game in 3.5 with evil characters where we designed an entire dungeon and each player claimed their own section. We had underground caves with lakes, a massive crypt, a huge temple to Tiamat, and a mad wizard's tower all in one location. And yeah, that's exactly the kind of thing I'm wanting to do. I agree with DM Nell that too much allowed expansion outside of the city might distract too much from the uniqueness of Primordia, but making whatever powers the Mythals rely on a rare and non-replenishable resource might help with that. Basically, you could allow for some expansion of the farmland or roads, and some of the key strongholds and castles could be reclaimed, but it wouldn't become a runaway expansion where now you have hundreds of miles of wilderness covered by Mythals. Having some kind of a resource that is relied on to make them could be a fun retrieval quest for the PCs. Yeah, and that's totally true, and that's definitely a way I could go. I'm thinking more that the Mythals will be difficult to build and expensive to build. So all that cost is really front-loaded in constructing it. Once the thing's up and running, if it works right, it doesn't need any resources or doesn't need replenishing because, again, these things work based on the old magic, which is kind of infinite. But the thing is these newer, smaller Mythals are going to be created by people who don't really understand what they're doing and don't really understand the magic that they're working with. So there are going to be flaws. But as opposed to having or going the route of, oh, you know, you need some plutonium or whatever, some unobtainium to fuel the Mythal, and now the PCs have to go do a fetch quest to get it. Instead of doing that, I'm just going to have there be malfunctions that are interesting that the PCs have to deal with. Josh Davis goes on to say, for the politics aspect, I definitely like having secret factions, making heavy use of that in my own world. That would be seeking to gain control of the portals. I also think that the guild should probably be receiving some kind of compensation for their role in maintaining, protecting, and expanding the Portal network. And yeah, they totally do. There's definitely a symbiotic relationship between the guild and the crown. I just haven't worked out all the details of that yet. And I don't think that that would be public knowledge. I don't think anyone outside of the guild and the queen actually knows all of the details of that arrangement. Perhaps they simply get some flat payment from the government taken out of general taxes so that they don't feel the need to charge people for the use of the portals. I don't recall off the top of my head, but you may have brought this up in a previous episode. Yeah, I don't recall either. I might have. Oh my gosh, there's been so much world building stuff. I can't keep track half the time of what I've talked about and what I haven't. And yeah, I'm definitely thinking that the expansion out of Alandria will be very slow. And again, the adventure I'm working on right now is going to be the involving the first keep that's going to try to be retaken by the player characters. And again, there's going to be problems with these force fields. I kind of see it like building these little force fields is almost like painting by numbers. You know, they're just following a recipe, but they don't really know what they're doing. So there's all kinds of opportunities for things to go wrong. So I don't think that the expansion of Alandria by reclaiming these castles and building missiles around them, it's not going to be a quick and easy fix. It's going to be a very slow and laborious fix with, you know, kind of a two steps forward, one step back kind of progression. So, you know, even over the course of multiple campaigns, I don't think we're going to see the campaign world change that much. And, you know, I really intend for the most part for the strongholds that are reclaimed are going to be the domains of player characters. So, you know, maybe for every two campaigns I run where a group establishes a stronghold, I'll have an NPC noble do one. You know, but the majority of the strongholds that I'm going to actually detail will be ones that have been claimed by groups of player characters. So, you know, I'm not going to be running that many campaigns. So there's not going to be that many of them. And I think there's also going to be a political side to this too. You know, the castle that the PCs are liberating is kind of like a trial run and they're going to get to keep it. But once it's been demonstrated that this can work, all the nobles are going to want a piece of it. And just deciding who gets to go next, you know, which estate are we going to reclaim next is going to be a huge mess and probably take weeks, if not months, of debating and arguing. And as this process of reclaiming these strongholds is going to rely upon close cooperation with the guild and the involved noble families, the noble families just can't do it on their own. They got to do it through the guild. They need the guild's adventuring teams to retake the keeps for them. And they need the guild scholars and mages to build the mythal for them. So the guild's going to kind of be able to at least have some say in who gets to go next, you know. And again, it's going to be a mess deciding how that decision is made, because obviously, you know, they're not going to want the guild just deciding who gets strongholds and who doesn't. They're not going to want just the queen deciding. You know, they're going to have to figure out a way where everybody kind of gets a voice and it's as fair as it can be. So again, I want to thank everyone who has commented on episode 118 and 119. Again, the majority of these comments have come from the Google Plus community. So if you're looking for a place to talk RPGs with other GMs and players, I strongly encourage you to join our Google Plus community. There's a lot of great stuff going on there. All right, well, that's going to wrap up episode 120 of Game Master's Journey. Once again, I want to send a huge thank you to G Ferg, Brett Nilsson, Boz Bunnick, DM Nell, and Josh Davis for your comments and discussion of the previous episodes. I've really enjoyed going over what you guys had to say today. A lot of great ideas, a lot of great thoughts. And again, I just want to reiterate that I think everybody's having great ideas here. I think all the ideas are great. And just by the nature of the beast, you know, I have to, for my world, pick and choose what I'm going to use, what I'm not going to use, how I'm going to do things. But that isn't to say just because I choose one idea over another that that idea is better or that the other idea is worse. It's just, you know, what is fitting my vision of my world the best, and what do I think is going to do what I'm wanting to do. But I love sharing this stuff on the show because, you know, it seems for like every idea that I'm like, yeah, I'm going to use that, there's three ideas that I kind of pass on, but they're all good ideas. And I'm hoping that for those of you out there listening who are building your own world, that these ideas are helping you with your world, that my ideas and the ideas of other GMs and listeners of the show can either give you ideas that you can just use in your world whole cloth, or maybe just spark a new idea of your own. And that's great stuff, you know. And I am always looking for inspirations for my world and for my adventures. For instance, I just recently grabbed a copy of Kobold Press's Tome of Beasts, which I will be reviewing on the show in depth in the near future. But my favorite thing about a book like that, I mean, it's just this huge ass book of monsters. It's nearly 500 pages. It's just full of ideas and inspirations. And yeah, there's a lot of those monsters that don't fit in Primordia, like a lot of the clockwork stuff and a lot of the really weird out there stuff just doesn't really fit in my version of, or my vision of Primordia. But a lot of this stuff could fit with some minor tweaking, and it all just gives me ideas, you know? So that's a great place to look for ideas for your world is a monster manual. And it doesn't even have to be for that particular game. For instance, I could turn to the bestiary for Numenera, I'm sure, and get some cool ideas for some monsters to create in Primordia. And I'm sure I'll be doing that. Ideas can come from anywhere, and you know, ideas are cheap, but at the same time, you can always use more good ideas. There's never such a thing as having too many ideas, because you can always find cool and interesting ways to combine those ideas together into something new and unique. So I hope that you have a chance to play your favorite RPG this week. I'll be back soon with another episode of Game Master's Journey. Until then, game on.
This has been a Starwalker Studios production, your source for quality gaming and hobby podcasts.
This episode's music provided by Cloudwalker, Renfield, Stanko, Transboy, and Ish. Please see the show notes for more details at starwalkerstudios.com/gamemastersjourney.